Hi, this is Dr. Linda Papadopoulos with The Psychology Behind. Now, today we've got a really special treat. We have Amy Morin on the show. Now, Amy is a psychotherapist who turned accidental author when she wrote a really popular column. It was basically a hack saying, these are the 13 things mentally strong people don't do. Now, since then, it's been turned into a book. She speaks about it in different countries. I think it's been turned into 30 different languages. And I think it's been so successful precisely because it breaks down those mistakes that we so often make when we're trying to get through difficulties in life. So with no further ado, I give you the brilliant Amy Morin. I want to welcome very warmly Amy Morin to the podcast. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. Now, I wanted to start from the beginning. When did you write this article? What made you write it? Because I know you're a psychotherapist. You've written for years. You've worked in this area for years. But what was it that made you look at sort of this issue from kind of a different way?
Yeah, so I was working as a psychotherapist, and about a year into my career, I lost my mother very suddenly and unexpectedly. And that sort of set me on a journey of wanting to know more about mental strength from a personal level. So I started studying people who came into my therapy office with a different lens, trying to figure out what made some people bounce back faster than others. How come some people could go through such tough times and they would grow from it, and other people would just seem to get reduced by it? And how come some people stayed stuck? And I realized it wasn't always about what people did. Sometimes it was more about what they didn't do. And then it was 3 years to the day that my mother passed away. My 26-year-old husband passed away suddenly from a heart attack. And so I found myself a widow at 26. And I thought, now what? What do I do with my life? And such a dark place, and for a long time. But I had, at least by that point, learned that getting through tough times wasn't always about what you did. Sometimes it was about what you didn't do. And so I focused really hard on not feeling sorry for myself and not getting stuck in a trap of self-pity, those sorts of things. And it took a long time for my heart to heal and to feel better. But a few years down the road, I was fortunate enough to fall in love again. I got remarried and got a new job, bought a new house, moved to a new area. And I thought, okay, this is my next chapter and life is looking good again. But just around that same time, my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And unlike when I'd lost my mom and my husband and it was so sudden and unexpected, this time I knew what was coming. Doctors told us he had maybe a couple of months left to live. And I found myself doing all of those things I had tried not to do. I was feeling sorry for myself. I was, you know, thinking, this isn't fair. I shouldn't have to do this. And I remembered, okay, if I'd learned anything, it was that that way of thinking would keep me stuck. So I sat down and I wrote a list of what mentally strong people don't do. And I read it over, and I would read it over and over again in the days after that. And I found it really helpful just to remind me, okay, no matter what, just don't do these certain things. And then I thought, well, if this list is helpful to me, maybe it would help somebody else. So I published it online and stepped away from my computer, never imagining it would go viral. I just hoped maybe one or two people would find it helpful. But it was read by more than 50 million people. Wow. And that one article changed the course of my career.
Wow. When you were going through that, the notion of loss to me is really interesting. You know, I think it's such a kind of visceral thing. I don't think it's any surprise that in every culture we mark things. We mark loss, especially very poignantly, very importantly. Was there something that you did to deal with that? How did you find that strength at that moment?
You know, I had always had a strong faith, and I found that definitely helpful when I was in my darkest moments. And, you know, and I had great friends and I had great family and things, people who were really supportive. But, you know, sort of one of the things that I did that I personally found really helpful was I went out and I bought a motorcycle after my husband passed away. And it was something that I'd always thought, oh, it'd be so neat to have a motorcycle. But it was one of those things I never really thought I would do. And so once I was widowed, I thought, you know, I'm just going to go do something that maybe I wouldn't have done when I was married, something kind of different. And it gave me some peace and solace. I would go for a motorcycle ride after work, and it was something to do. I could get out in nature and enjoy these back roads and an opportunity to sort of think about life in a different way. And, you know, and it felt sort of rebellious all at the same time. I'm sort of the last person you would think would be riding a motorcycle if you looked at me. But it was just, you know, it was one of those moments where I thought, you know, I can, even though my life is completely different, it's up to me to rebuild it, and I get to choose how I rebuild it. And if I want to drive a motorcycle, I can do that. And, you know, I don't have a motorcycle anymore, but for a couple of years, I found that to be just a really helpful thing in my life.
Tell me a bit about this idea of not wasting time feeling sorry for yourself, because again, sort of working clinically as well, you know, you sit across from people every day, and it's a privilege to kind of see how people deal with pain and suffering. And it's actually, you know, sometimes people go through really hard times and seems that they have a disproportionate amount of bad luck or good luck. When you spoke to people, what were those stories about not feeling sorry for yourself? How does someone actually not do that?
So I think one important factor was just looking at, am I feeling sad and it's something that's helpful, or am I feeling sorry for yourself? So wallowing goes beyond just feeling sad, because being sad is part of the healing process. Grief is a process by which we heal, and feeling sad can be part of that. But when we wallow, it's when you start to think, you know, my problems are worse than everybody else's. I can't, there's no solution. There's nothing I can do. And you get to be hopeless and helpless. So really differentiating, am I sad or am I wallowing? If you're wallowing, then you need to do something different. And for me personally, something I could do even in when I was feeling really bad was to say, well, what do I still have to offer the world? I can still help somebody. I still needed to have some sort of meaning. I needed to feel like I was able to give back in some sort of a way. So whether I volunteered, you know, once in a great while, or I did something that just really helped me know, okay, I still have opportunities to give back, to brighten somebody else's day. And no matter how bad I feel, it's all about the choices I make. I could choose to lay in bed and stay in a dark room all the time, but that'll just make me feel worse. What am I going to do? And it was about taking some kind of action. And one of the things I had noticed after my mother passed away was, you know, anniversaries, her birthday, those days were really, really tough. So when we were approaching what was going to be my husband's 27th birthday without him, I had this conversation with my mother-in-law about what are we going to do that day? I didn't want to go to work as a therapist because I thought I'll be too in too rough a shape to help other people. But at the same time, if I take the day off and sit at home and just stare at the walls, I'm just going to end up feeling sorry for myself. And so we decided to go skydiving. And now every year we still do it to this day. We go out and go on some sort of family adventure to say, let's still celebrate his birthday, even though he's not here with us. Wow. That's better than just sitting around and feeling sorry for ourselves. Let's celebrate what we had rather than feel sorry for all that we lost. And it was just a tangible way to say, let's take charge. Let's do something. Let's take some kind of action to say, how are we proactively going to fight against hosting a pity party?
Yeah. Well, it's also reclaiming and reframing, right? Maybe that's the other thing that came across really strongly from your list to me, this idea of the sense of volition, like each and every one of your steps to me is about what can I do? What can I control? And so I love that skydiving is about control here, because you're saying it to me and like, I'm like, but it sounds brilliant. Was your husband very adventurous? Is that part?
Yes, that was part of it. Yeah. He loved to travel. He loved to get out and do things. So we decided, let's do that. And so every year we've done something. We don't skydive, but we rode mules into the Grand Canyon, or we've gone zip lining, or we swam with sharks. So this becomes something we look forward to.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant. So one of the other things that you speak about that I really loved is this idea of giving away power, right? So this, you know, idea of what you can control, right? So giving someone permission to make you feel less than, or recognizing how to react to it, right? So can you tell me a little bit about this notion of how to deal with emotions, how not to give away power?
Right. This one is really about our tendency sometimes to blame other people for how we feel. We say things like, you know, that person made me so mad, or that person makes me feel bad about myself. But when we use that kind of language, it just implies that other people have power over how we feel or how we behave. Or when we let people bring out the worst in us, or you say somebody else ruined your day, you're giving all of those people power over your life. And even though it's just a couple of words, just changing the way that you think about it, recognizing, okay, this is a choice. I'm in control of how I think, feel, and behave. And that makes a big difference in your outlook and the choices that you're going to make. And it just helps you to feel more empowered to say, okay, my life is, it's all about the choices I make from the time I wake up until the time I go to bed. And then you can do things a little bit differently. And even the things that we think, all right, it's not really a choice to go to work. I have to go to work. But nobody's forcing you to. And just recognizing that, okay, I'm choosing to go to work today because if I don't, I won't earn any money. And if I don't have any money, then I won't be able to afford the things that I want. And so just recognizing, okay, here are the choices in my life, and this is what I'm choosing to do. And that just really helps me personally, but it's helped a lot of my clients just feel more empowered.
Yeah, no, and I think you're absolutely spot on. And this idea of the language that we use, right, to regulate the way we feel or to make sense of things, because it is this idea that no one speaks to you more than you speak to yourself. So if you're always, you know, this blaming game and woe is me, it really kind of doesn't serve to make you feel like you can change. Because I guess there's something about responsibility and power, right? You know, if you don't take responsibility, then there's no power, there's no volition, there's no way to kind of change something. And I think that I love this idea that you're quoted saying, my boss makes me feel bad. You know, well, is that something that he does, or is that something you allow him to do? And I think, again, something about responding to your internal process, right? So whether it's anxiety or feeling low, there's something about, am I responding to the externality of what's happening, or what's going on inside me?
That's it, exactly. And, you know, again, it goes back to, what can you control? You can't control how other people behave, but you can control how you respond to them. And when you just really put your energy into the things you can control, life just really changes. It becomes much different when you say, okay, I don't need to waste my energy wishing other people would act differently or hoping that something's going to change at work. Instead, it's about saying, what do I have power over? How do I focus my energy into things that will actually create real change?
Absolutely. No. And again, I mean, the one thing that I find kind of in this area as well is adaptability, right? So I think people that are good at life are about, you know, again, sort of this, you know, being able to kind of roll with the punches. And part of that is precisely about how they manage their power with the situation. But part of it is they don't shy away from change, right? They expect it. And that's a big thing, I think, especially in a society where there seems to be the way things ought to be. And like, and I think this kind of toxic notion that, you know, happiness is a place that you reach and you're there and you're done. And actually, it's not that. You don't know what's around the corner. And there's got to be something very satisfying in terms of making people feel safe about knowing, regardless, if I'm not trying to avoid change, if I'm not trying to stay with the status quo, then what's around the corner is something I feel that I can handle.
Yeah, so many people would come into my therapy office, and even though their lives were really in a difficult spot, they would say, well, I don't want to do anything different because I might make it worse. Or, you know, or even when things are really rough, they would say, well, at least it's predictable. I know what to expect. And they'd really dig in their heels, and they'd come in and they'd tell me, I want to change my life. But when it came down to making those changes, it was uncomfortable and they were scared of that. And I knew for me personally, in my experience, my entire world had changed. And if I could have dug in my heels and tried to keep it the same, I wouldn't have been able to adapt and to move forward. And I really think a lot of our success in life depends on our willingness to try to adapt. But that takes a leap of faith. You have to say, okay, I can handle being uncomfortable, and this may not work out, but I'm going to go for it anyway.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think there is something about, you know, people preferring to be uncomfortable than to be around the unknown, isn't it? I think that's why we stay in, you know, whatever it is, bad relationships, bad jobs, bad anything, because it's better the devil you know. So one of the ones that really strikes me, so I do a lot of work with young women, and this idea about pleasing everyone really struck a chord with me. Tell me, is this something that you went through personally, as, you know, this idea of needing to please, of to be, you know, whatever that means, you know, do the right thing, be, you know, be the good girl? Is that something that you felt?
Yeah, it's, you know, growing up, I was somebody that was very eager to please. I was sort of the shy kid in the back of the classroom who wouldn't want to make waves, wouldn't want to make anybody angry. And for much of my life, I was really uncomfortable if I thought somebody didn't like me, or if I thought somebody was angry at me. And, you know, over the years, I just had to learn that that's okay. But it was something I constantly had to practice. And even as I went through grief, there were certain expectations from other people about how I should be grieving, or how I would look, how I would look when I was grieving. And I just really had to accept this is my own journey, and that other people aren't going to understand, and that that's okay. And it's not even my job to try to make them understand. Instead, I could just be comfortable knowing that other people might not be pleased with how I live my life or what I'm doing. And that was okay.
Yeah, there's something really amazing when you realize that you can tolerate not being liked, isn't there?
Yes.
I mean, it took me a while to get there, because there's this feeling that, of course, we're social beings, right? You want to be liked, obviously. But if you recognize that, do you know what? It's not the end of the world. And actually, it makes sense that sometimes people aren't going to be pleased with what you do, especially if that means you're taking care of your needs, whatever those are. It's really liberating, isn't it?
It really is. And to know that, you know, it's again, it's not up to you to make people like you or to convince them. You don't have to put your energy into trying to earn their favor. That's okay. Those aren't your people. Move on and find your people.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff sort of written around kind of the idea of sort of young women and confidence, and precisely this need to kind of be the good girl means that they don't often take risks, right? Because that means that, you know, I'm going to say something and I'm going to get it wrong, or you're going to think less of me. And actually, you know, freeing yourself from, you know, from, because it's a shackle. It's a shackle that limits you. It's very limiting, the same way we're speaking about with, you know, not adapting. It's one of those other shackles. When you recognize that actually it's okay, it's not the end of the world. And if anything, I think it allows you to like yourself more. There's something about, you know, we talk about self-esteem a lot. I think self-esteem is being able to sometimes just stick up for what's really going on inside you rather than just taking everyone else's temperature all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I had so many women, especially women, who would come into my therapy office and say, well, I didn't want to be selfish, so I'll do anything anybody asks me to do. And then when we would really unpack that, though, it was often their willingness to do things they didn't want to do. It came down to something that actually was selfish, because they said, you know, I want to be liked. I want to be held in high regard.
Ah.
And it really shifting their perspective on understanding people can handle it if you say no. And it's not the end of the world that they'll get over it. But the only reason that a lot of these people keep asking you for favors is because you keep saying yes. And it's really about practicing saying no sometimes and then tolerating the discomfort that you feel and seeing that the world doesn't end, or that people who really like you for you are okay with that.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. One of the other ones that, again, I mean, everything you said is brilliant, but this, you know, this idea of not dwelling on the past. I read this brilliant quote the other day about forgiveness, and it was something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like, I think forgiveness is about giving up hope for a better past, or, you know, just this need to kind of rewrite the past. Because this dwelling, and we know much more sort of around the kind of, you know, neuropsychology around why it's hard, especially when we've gone through something difficult in the past, why we keep dwelling on it. But there is something, again, about, you know, being mentally strong enough to not keep wishing something didn't happen or you had done things differently, because it turns into this itch that constantly needs scratching, this really negative cycle. And again, with loss, that's a really big one, isn't it? Sort of like, you know, had I spotted this, had I done that? When you think about this idea of dwelling and again, sort of being able to let go, what were the practical things that you yourself used, or that you've used with your clients kind of to help them do that?
So, you know, making peace with the past, it's a little bit different depending on the situation. Sometimes people were holding on to anger against somebody else, and they thought, all right, if I just hold this grudge long enough, somehow it'll punish the other person. And so it would become about helping them see that they were just punishing themselves. And at other times, I worked with people who dwelled on the past because that they really thought that the best times in their life were behind them. So whether somebody said, you know, my life was better when the kids lived at home, or college was the best years of my life, or you know, when I was married, my life was much better. And because of that, they just really weren't able to enjoy life now. They couldn't make life as good as it could be in the future. And so it's really sometimes just about figuring out, how do you learn from the past without staying stuck there, that you can reflect on it? But reflecting and dwelling are two different things. Reflecting is really about thinking about it in a way that helps you move forward, whereas dwelling is about ruminating and rehashing and staying stuck there.
Yeah. Again, there's a comfort. It kind of reminds me of, you know, when you're a teenager and you have bad skin and you pick at it, right? And you know it's going to make the skin worse, but you just, there's this compulsion to it. And I think there is this almost compulsion that comes, this sort of, you know, around sort of just going in that circular thinking. And that only leads to, in a way, that's almost a necessarily a self-harm, but I think there's a comfort in that discomfort. And I think there's something about cutting through that. So whether it is like you say, just doing something completely different, changing the, you know, the way that you begin to talk about it, changing how much space it takes up, even sort of, you know, rejigging your nervous system into doing something completely different, listening to something different, seeing something. All of these things, I think, really help, because that dwelling is a big problem when it comes to, I think, a lot of mental health issues, you know, be it sort of life problems that happen, but also things like depression and anxiety, where it just becomes your go-to place. And that, again, leads me on to your point about not making the same mistakes over and over. So part of that is, again, acceptance, right? So it kind of goes hand in hand with dwelling. You know, once you accept that maybe I've made a mistake or maybe this is over, then you take what you can learn from it and you let the rest go.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, how many of us will say, I'm never going to do that again? And then we go out and do that very same thing. And so I think it's something that we've all done, where we end up repeating some of our mistakes, whether it's a romantic relationship issue or it's a mistake that you made in college when it came to studying, or some sort of work-related mistake, or maybe something to do with your health. Tons of mistakes that we make. But it's so easy to not spend enough time figuring out, okay, why'd you make the mistake and how can you learn from it? Instead, sometimes we just beat ourselves up for it, or we just jump back into action and think, well, I won't do that again. And then you do. And so I think it's about taking the appropriate amount of time to reflect, to figure out, what did I learn from this and how do I move forward stronger and better, rather than allowing myself to get caught up in this cycle of repeating it over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think, you know, it's not hard, it's not easy, in this day and age, to kind of, I guess, be aware of how many times those mistakes come from the resentment we have of our shoulds and have tos, what we ought to be doing, especially given that we're constantly exposed to the superlatives of everyone's life, you know, be it on social media or how we fetishize success. So, you know, and again, you know, when you speak to people who have had their own success, one of the things that they're very good at is that they want their success and not somebody else's, that they're good at being able to appreciate, you know, other people's. And I remember when years ago, when I was trying to have a baby and I was very unlucky with miscarriages, and I remember I would see pregnant women everywhere and my heart would be like, oh. And I remember my husband saying, but you know, it's your baby you want, it's your pregnancy. And I remember that really helped me. There's this idea that, of course, somebody else having a baby or having 10 kids didn't mean anything for my, you know what I mean, what I wanted. And I think that's a mistake that we often make with success, this idea that if someone else has it, then somehow, you know, it's a testament to our ability or it affects our chances. So kind of, I think, having that clarity of it's you on your terms and it's your thing that you should want is really important. And I think I wonder how much of being exposed to the way that we fetishize it so much is affecting people. I was in a bookshop the other day, and the amount of autobiographies, I mean, I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, we have a lot of sort of disposable celebrity. You're on like a TV show for 6 weeks and then you get the book deal and everything. So you've got autobiographies by 18, 19 year olds. And it just, you know, feels like if you don't have the success fast enough, then there's something wrong with you. And I just kind of, it makes me feel kind of worried about what we're buying into, this idea that you need to have it, you need to have it fast, and you need to have it for everyone to see.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, the social media definitely feeds into that, where people think, if I don't have enough Instagram followers or I don't get enough likes on my content, then somehow I'm not good enough. And fuels this idea that, yes, I need to do this as fast as I can, and I need to get as much attention or as much money as I possibly can, and I have to do it right now. And it really distorts our idea of what success means to us. And it's easy to lose sight of our values and to really get caught up in all of the buzz and the fanfare associated with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things I do in this podcast is I ask everybody to tell me something significant, three significant things in their life. I ask for a moment, so a crossroads in your life that you feel really changed things. I ask for a comfort, which is your go-to thing when you're feeling down, when things aren't going great. And I ask for a compass, which is, I guess, what directs and motivates us for the future. So I was hoping we could do that together. Can we start with your moment? What was kind of, you know, that seminal moment in your life that you feel really changed things?
So right after, I guess it was a while after my husband had passed away, and I was sort of stuck thinking, okay, what am I going to do with my life? How am I going to rebuild a new life for myself? I had so many hopes and dreams, or foster parents, or planning to adopt, and I had to figure out which of these things do I want to hold on to and what don't I want to hold on to. And I heard this, there was this moment where I heard this story about another young woman who had recently gotten married, and her husband had passed away sort of in similar circumstances as mine. It was sudden and unexpected. She couldn't afford to keep the place that they lived in, and so she suddenly had to move within about a month of when he passed away. And it was this moment where I thought, gosh, how fortunate am I that I don't have to move? She had to make all of these decisions about where was she going to live, how was she going to pack up his belongings. She had to move everything against her will. And I thought, all right, I don't have to do that. I can afford to keep our house. I don't have to empty out his closets. I don't have to do all of this stuff if I don't want to right now. And it was this moment of thinking, okay, so if I don't have to make these decisions then right now, then I can just sit with it for a long time. Because I felt like I was under a lot of pressure before that to make all these life decisions. And then that moment just reminded me, no, I'm not. I don't have to make all these decisions. I can just wait. And that was actually how I got into writing, was I wanted to earn some extra money on the side just to make sure I was comfortable when it came to finances. But really just hearing that story was a reminder of, you know, quit thinking that you have to make all these decisions right now, because you don't. Here's this woman who really has to make a lot of decisions and she doesn't want to. And I had the luxury of not having to move and not having to do all of those things right in that moment.
And I think, again, just that ability to do things on your own terms must have been just very, and recognizing where you thought there was no control, again, that there is some, right? That I don't, you know, these are choices I can make in my own time, must have just felt really powerful.
It did. And it was a reminder. And, you know, as a therapist, I could only work so many hours. I couldn't work 100 hours a week. I was working 40 hours, and that was plenty. Wow. But I could write in the evenings and on the weekends. And if I wanted to earn some extra money, that was an option. And so it just really opened my eyes to my choices, to my options, and to know, okay, this is all about what do I have control over? This is something I have some control over.
Beautiful, beautiful. And tell me about your comfort.
So one thing I've definitely found comfort in is running. Ever since I was a kid, I've loved to run. And so it's something I could do even no matter how bad I felt. It doesn't cost any money. It's, you know, all you need is a pair of sneakers. And so it's something I still do to this day. I try to go running almost every day. And if I want to listen to a podcast while I run, I can. If I want to just take some time to myself, sometimes my husband goes with me, but sometimes I go alone. But it's something that I just love to do. I can think, or I cannot think, or I can challenge myself, or I can just make it a leisurely pace. So I just love being able to get out in nature and run.
Oh, amazing. I was reading recently about mindful running, which I thought was really interesting, which is how many steps you take between breaths and just kind of looking at sort of leaves as you go or the sounds. I thought there's something, there's got to be something evolutionary about kind of just being outside, right? And running as well. And just kind of just that idea of movement in your body. I mean, you know, with depression, there's, you know, reams written on the importance of movement. And I think in this sedentary world we live in, just kind of the simplicity of, you know, of that beat as you run, of that, you know, of being out, or even if you're not outside and you're doing it inside, but just kind of being one with that must be, yeah. I'm very big on sort of movement when it comes to mental health as well. And finally, tell me a bit about your compass. What gets you up in the morning? How do you orientate? How do you motivate?
So I guess it's right now I have so much freedom that it's just incredible to me that I get to write books, I get to write articles, I get to kind of have a lot of flexibility over my day. And I just find that so exciting that I can decide what I want to do and how I want to spend my time, and sort of to the nth degree, I have lots of flexibility. And just really excited about now I get to share my message, not just in a therapy office, but I get to do it on a global level. And it's just so exciting to me that I can't wait to get out of bed every day.
Well, we're delighted you got out of bed to speak to us today, Amy. I can't thank you enough. And I do hope you make it over to London. And yeah, I'd love to see you when you're next here. But again, Amy's book, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, is available wherever you get your books. And Amy, can you tell us where people can find out more about you, maybe your Twitter, your social media?
Sure. My website is Amy Morin, LCSW, as in licensed clinical social worker.com. And that's my Twitter handle as well, Amy Morin LCSW. And on Instagram, I'm Amy Morin Author.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Amy. And I've got your list here and I will be reading it again and again because I just think it's awesome, as are you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to my chat with Amy. I certainly loved speaking to her. It's wonderful when you're able to kind of, I guess, take what life throws at you and to turn it into something that you feel you have control over, which is precisely what Amy did and what Amy writes about. I think the only thing that is certain is that we don't know what's around the corner in life. You know, the only thing that is certain is that things will change. The sooner we recognize the difference between fearing change and embracing how to adapt to it, the more we approach our lives and our future with bravery and with hope, which is precisely what she did. It was a great talk. I've taken a lot away from that. I hope you have too. And as always, I love to hear from you. So please, you know, keep those comments coming in. If you're enjoying the podcast, share it with your friends, you know, rate, review, subscribe. And until we meet again, I wish you a very healthy, happy body and mind.